Hello, I'm Caroline Baum, and welcome to this podcast of a conversation recorded live at True Story, the festival of non-fiction held on the land of the Wadi Wadi people at the South Coast Writers Centre at Coaldale in New South Wales. We pay our respects to the traditional owners of the land and their storytellers. You could have heard a pin drop when the velvet voice of the ABC, Margaret Throsby, talked to Bruce Pascoe about his best-selling book Dark Emu and its impact on his life, and Black Duck, his most recent book with his wife, about their farm near Mallacoota.
He's a Yuin, Bunurong and Tasmanian man. His farm is home to Black Duck Foods, which is a blueprint for traditional food growing and land management processes based on ancient practices. Black Duck is the book he wrote with his wife, Lynn Harwood. So that's setting the scene. Black Duck, actually, I read it almost in 2 days. It reads so easily. It's like a diary, Bruce, isn't it, of a year at Black Duck. Why did you decide to do it like that?
Well, it was the publisher who had the idea for the book, and Sally Heath, a great book person, and she wanted it broken down into the six Aboriginal seasons, but we couldn't get away from the idea that it was organised by birds, and so for us it was generated by the change in bird life and animal life on the property.
The birds are real characters in this
book,
aren't
characters,
they?
They're real characters, but the lapwing is an interesting bird, the plover. The Yuin word for that bird is Birundurundurun, and it's such an intensely private bird. It's got a real personality. You know, king parrots will sit on your shoulder, on your head, eat out of your hand. Jitty Jitty, the willy wagtail, will entertain you all day. But the plover, you are just a bloody nuisance to it. And it treats you like that.
Yes, it does.
It treats you with a kind of respectful disdain, if I could say it like that. And I love them because I love that. I love their independence. But also, you don't need a dog if you've got a lapwing, because they will comment on every sound in the bush. A rubber tyre cannot come onto our roadway 3 kilometres away without Birundurundurun telling you so.
Really?
And all the other birds, if you watch closely in the bush, all the other birds, when that Birundurundurun talks, all the other birds go, what's going on? they're wonderful things, you know. Yeah. But now they are also our ancestors. They are family members of ours. And, you know, obviously Birundurundurun's my cranky auntie.
Cranky auntie. Tell me, give us an idea of the place where this farm is. It's near Mallacoota, isn't it?
Yeah, we're upstream from the little town of Mallacoota on the Wallagra River. And the Wallagra goes past the farm, but within sight we also see the Jinor come down out of the mountains, and it's joined by the Maramingo. So these are salt rivers. So there's three salt rivers all join, and they form the Mallacoota Lakes. That journey, which I do as often as I can, from the farm down through the rivers and the lakes to the township of Mallacoota, is one of the great journeys of the world.
So how big is the property? What's the landscape like? What do you grow there? What trees are there?
It's 140 acres, and we grow kangaroo grass, wallaby grass, spear grass, and a lot of the tubers as well on that property, because the reaction to dark emu scared me, because I thought, there was far too much enthusiasm for the food and none for the people. So we needed to demonstrate that Aboriginal people were still in touch with their food culture, because I knew Justice Olney and the Yorty Order told me that if you don't emphasise your connection to country, you're going to lose it. It was the cheapest farm in Gippsland when I bought it, and because I had my eye on a place closer to Eden. But fortuitously, it was a wonderful thing to do, because it has a saline environment because of the salt rivers. It also has a fresh water environment, and it has dry hills and forests. So in the forest, we've got magnificent ironbarks, one of the great trees in Australia, but also angophoras. Now, angophora is a beautiful tree, has weeping foliage, corky bark, just a stunningly beautiful tree, but it's no good for timber making, and that's why they're still around. The biggest trees in Gippsland are always angophora, because timber millers left them alone. But then there's a lot of wattle, there's a lot of blueberry ash, stringy bark. It's a beautiful forest.
Did the fires of 2019-20 come close to you or through your property or
what? Yeah, it went right through us three times, and we're very, very fortunate not to lose my house and Lynn's house at Gypsy Point. By the time the fire got to us, you could approach it. So with fire tankers and, manual tools, you could approach the fire and do something useful. When it got a bit hairy, you could extract yourself from the situation. Several times I thought we'd lost Lynn's place, and a couple of times I thought my place was gone. But we were so fortunate.
I don't think any of us could forget the look of the footage from Mallacoota. For some reason, the Mallacoota fire stuck right in my mind. That dystopian picture of the people putting out to sea with the red sky. It makes me cry just to think of it, actually, how people prevailed. But and you fought the fires, didn't you? You went in your little boat down the river. Bruce has got a series of boats called Nadji, is that right?
Yeah. I've only one at a time. The others are.
Well, there was Nadji 1, yeah. Nadji 2, Nadji 3, Nadji 4.
Don't get me started talking about boats. We haven't got enough time. But look, that was the fact there was a Navy vessel offshore, I think, stuck in people's mind, because suddenly here's an Australian town vacating their home by sea.
Yeah.
It was the reverse of, children overboard. But for us, there was a kind of a normality for the townspeople, because this is our town. We know it intimately, even though it had transformed. But I had my boat in the water, so I was able to travel around. All the roads were blocked and stayed blocked for months. And you just couldn't move. I kept my farm road open, using the chainsaw and things. But I did that about six times to keep that open. So the waterway was the saviour. So I got down to Mallacoota when people were being shipped out to that Navy vessel. And I'll never forget it, because people were holding their cats, their dogs, two kids, and no one said a word. They were in deep shock. Some of them were local people. Most of them were holiday makers who had to evacuate. And there was total silence. And I had this advantage of being able to operate and having a function, a role, whereas They just didn't know what had happened to them. And there were some pretty ugly scenes that, never leave your mind. But, poor old Mallacoota, eh?
Poor old Mallacoota.
You know, it's going to be a horrible summer as well.
Getting back to your property, and you said that there are all different kinds of grasses. They're not just grasses that look like grasses. They're grasses that make food, don't they? So can we talk about that a bit? Because that's foundational to black duck foods, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really a political statement. To grow those foods, as I said, I'll never forget Justice Olney saying that the Yorta Yorta people couldn't have their land back because their culture had been washed away by the tide of history. And I thought after Dark Emu, at some point, Aboriginal people are going to say something about intellectual property over food, and some judge is going to say, well, you can't have it. You know, it's now Nabisco or Nestle or Monsanto owns that now. So establishing the farm was a political act, but it was also a spiritual act for the community to be, you know, have those young people come onto the farm and begin to learn about those grasses and to convert them from a very tiny seed into flour and then make bread from them. They were very, very dramatic days for us. And I'll never forget the first time we started up the harvester. We were really busy. We had so much to do that day. We knew it was going to be harvest day. The crop was at its peak, and we knew that this was the day it was going to happen. And everyone's running around getting all the equipment we needed. But when it came to the time when someone jumped on the little quad bike that we were harvesting with at that stage to tow the harvester, Terry got on the bike. And Terry is a Mumbler. His family is Mumbler. There's a mountain named after that family. And I looked around because I knew we were about to start, and we're all nervous as cats. And I looked around, and there's Terry. And I thought, then, you know, that's about perfect. You know, having, you know, that rich family history, re-engaging with the crop was pretty remarkable. I mean, the person who does most on the farm now is a Nyampa man, Chris Harris. He's a motorbike freak, and he's got the steel rods in his legs to prove it. But he can fix anything. I'm so lucky to, you know, have his company on the farm because he can make all these machines sing, and he's adapted everything to the seed size of kangaroo grass and spear grass, and he's invented stuff, and he's, you know, he's had his culture from his father and his grandfather. He's very, very deeply involved in his culture, but so he then had this opportunity to start with the grasses and the tubers. You know, we're selling a lot of vanilla lily and chocolate lily at the moment. They're superb vegetables. You know, people will be eating those instead of carrots because it's a perennial crop. Where they stay in the ground, they sequester carbon, and from one plant we might harvest 20 or 30 tubers, and we'll do that four times a year.
It's a long distance from the seed as it's growing and it gets harvested to producing a grain that you can actually make into bread. Does that all happen on the property too?
Yeah, that's what. That's why Chris has been so important, because of his ability with machines.
Okay.
Because it goes through four or five processes. to clean the seed and get it to the point where we could put it through the and grind it into flour.
And what's the bread like?
It's sensational.
Is it?
You know, I say that the Lynn gets cranky with me because I, when people say, what does vanilla lily taste like? I say, champagne. And she said, no, it doesn't. It tastes, you know.
Tastes like vanilla lily.
But for me, when I first started eating it, I thought, that's got the zest of champagne and the crunch of water chestnut. You know, it's a beautiful vegetable. And, you know, I'm allowed to talk it up. I thought, champagne, you know. But the when we first started cooking with the flour that we had made, it's very dark flour, but incredibly aromatic. When you start the oven up and you put that that dough in the oven, the whole kitchen is transformed. I still remember when I was about five going to a baker and they gave us buns, you know, and it's just in my mind. But the smell of the bakery, I can still bring it back. But the smell of kangaroo grass bread or particularly Microlenis dipoides, dancing grass, Mamaja Naluk, the smell of that is just something that Australians are going to love. You know, and I've just been reassured that the in the referendum vote in this town was very strongly yes. Well, the rest of Australia is going to get this opportunity again, and I want Australians to know that this offer is still being made. You know, eat this, smell this. This is yours. It comes from your country. You don't have to import bread dough from Ireland anymore because it's here.
Mm. And it's gluten-free.
Once again, Lynn says you can't always say it's gluten-free because speargrass has a fraction of gluten in it.
Oh, you said it in the book, Bruce.
When we harvest kangaroo grass, we always pick up a bit of speargrass as well. We can't physically separate them. So,
are you making commercial quantities of bread?
John Elliott, the great Australian entrepreneur, would say no. but what would he know? You know, we sell to Honor Bread in Bermagui. We sell to a fantastic little bakery in Candalo. We sell to Wild Rise in Pambula. We sell to Mabu Mabu in Melbourne, both flour and vanilla lily. We're battling to, you know, pay for the labour, but look, we had to prove we could do it, and we've done that.
What's the philosophy behind Black Duck Foods?
It's to show that Aboriginal people had a good diet, which they got from this country in a sustainable way for 120,000 years.
And trod lightly on the land.
Very lightly, and that everyone worked hard. You know, to do this kind of job with a mortar and pestle is very hard. You know, the forearms of men and women who ground a seed into flour changed is because of the force and the amount of work that your forearm does, the bone changes. And so they can identify those people who made bread and those who didn't by looking at the forearm. And so those old people worked really hard. You know, I hate, you know, people talking about blackfella time and sit down time and all that, because our people worked really hard and our people were incredibly well educated. Kids went through not 12 years of schooling but 50, 60 years of schooling, and it was a really viable society. And what was the question?
The question was the philosophy behind Black Duck Foods. What I'm trying to get to is, do you employ just Aboriginal people to work at Black Duck Foods, for instance?
Yes, we try to. We have had a few non-Aboriginal people who worked there. During COVID, these hippies rocked up and mad as cut snakes, but they wanted to help. This is after the fires as well. And a few of them were just very good workers, you know, non-Aboriginal people, but worked their guts out. I'll never forget them because I was as flat as I've ever been after the fires. And, you know, I'd look around and I'd say, what is that bloody person doing? You know, oh, shit, they've put the glass back in the window, you know, because a lot of the windows are broken in the fire because of the heat. And I see, a young woman who I didn't think knew what putty was fixing a window.
Yeah.
And so I thought, geez, you know, if that kid can do it, I can do it. Because I've been looking at that bloody window for 3 months.
One of your great supporters is Marcia Langton, and she cautions that many Aboriginal people aren't work ready. They've no experience with the demands of work and planning for it. How do you address that? How do you approach that?
With persistence. You know, Marcia is a great Australian. And a lot of our people come from homes where no one in that family has had a job in three generations. So those kids have never seen their dad jump out of bed and go to work, never seen their mum go off to work. And the things that you've got to do, pack your lunch, put your shoes on, all of these very basic things those kids have not done. You don't do this of your own volition. You learn it from your parents. So we have to put a lot of work into that. And we had the Guyong Festival at Eden at Jigami last weekend. And I was speaking to one old lady there who's a feisty old thing and doesn't take any prisoners. And she said, you know, why isn't my granddaughter still working with you? And I said, well, if she had a hard night the night before, she wouldn't get up. And, you know, we'd come by and we'd wait for half an hour while she had a shower and, you know, we can't do that. And she said, but she's a good worker. And I said, yeah, my oath, she's a bloody good worker. That's why we wanted her on the farm. But she has to do that every day. You know, working is about repetition. Even when you don't want to do the repetition, it's about bloody doing it. And, you know, Marcia copped a lot of flack by saying that not all Aboriginal people were work ready. But in some cases, it's quite true. And we have to teach those kids how to work, what they need to do. Do they have a water bottle? You know, have they got their own lunch? You know, pretty basic things. But they're the sort of things that dispossession and suppression have caused generations of people to not have that experience that their grandfathers and grandmothers had. And one of the good brothers from Bairnsdale was working in the lands department, this is 20 or 30 years ago, and he was asked, as the resident blackfella, he was asked to clean out all the drawers, these big map drawers. And in the bottom of one drawer, he found a map of Mallacoota. And every word on it, apart from the surveyor's name, McCabe, was Aboriginal. And when I first came to Mallacoota as a school teacher, I was told very proudly that no Aboriginal people had ever lived there. And, you know, I from my uncle, I knew that that wasn't correct. And I also knew that some of the people who were telling me that had Aboriginal blood in their family, because that's what happens to fishermen. You know, Mallacoota was a fishing society, and it did have an Aboriginal history, and still does. And that map is got minute writing all through it, and a lot of the time it's saying open grassland, herbage, sparse forest. And now the trees are, you know, a metre and a half apart.
So we've planted them or what? I mean, how's that come about?
It's just what happens when you don't burn.
Oh,
so
I see.
We do a lot of cultural burning down there, and we do it on the farm a lot because that's how we regenerate the kangaroo grass.
Is that what is called cool burning?
Cool burning, cultural burning.
So can you tell us about the process?
Look, it's a lovely thing to do, but we need to get heaps of young people working in the bush to light these fires and stand by them. So we need, in any crew, you'd need a dozen young people. You wait until the weather's right. You know, a fortnight from now is going to be too late on my farm. You won't be able to touch it. But over winter, if we get a few dry days in a row with a good wind, we know that after that wind has dropped, we can light the bush and watch it trickle through the grassland, you know, and it'll burn, you know, baby wattle trees, baby eucalypts, and a yellow flowering shrub, which is comes up after the fire. You need to knock that back a bit. You're not going to alter the biodiversity.
Can you do that sort of burning in thick bush, heavy bush?
You can, but you need people. You need the right day. You know, when the CFA does what they call a control burn, they come down like an army. they try to pick the weather. They do the best they can, but they've come from Melbourne or Shepparton or somewhere like that, and they have to burn that day. And we say to them, you know, it's not right. You know, you have to wait until next Wednesday. It'll be good next Wednesday. They say, no, we've got to do it today.
Yeah.
Whereas we pick our day, we light the bush, and we walk beside it as it creeps along, literally at this rate. And we say to the young people who we're teaching this method to, you know, don't put on fireproof clothing. You know, do it in your thongs if you have to, because if you have got a fire that you can't walk through, it's too hot. You've got to be able to walk through that flame or walk around it. The flame should not be any higher than that. Any higher than that and you've lost it. So every time we see a little bit of a spurt like that, we'll put that bit out. So you need people on the ground. And, you know, we always have a lovely day. It's such a peaceful thing to do, to watch fire move through the landscape as calmly as that. And, you know, we had one down on the flat near the river the other day. And I had, you know, a lot of visitors on the farm. And now they said, what are you going to do? How are you going to stop it? You know, once it had, I said, you know, because I'm a wise old bushman. I said, well, look, at 4:30, the dew will start to come in and it'll put the fire out. And I said, well, it's not going to put that fire out. I said, well, wait to 4:30, you know, it's still only 2:30. And it wasn't the dew, the moist air coming in that put the fire out. It was the shadows. And I'd never seen that before, never noticed it before. I should have known. But just the shadows of the trees elongating and touching the fire put it out like that.
Oh, wow.
And it was just the drop in temperature.
If we go back to dark emu, do you mind if we talk about that for a bit? Or are you so over it you don't want to say another word about it?
No, look, you know, dark emu is a tool and the country is using it pretty frequently. So, you know, we need to talk about it.
Why did it touch a nerve so profoundly? I mean, 400,000 copies is an extraordinary.
Yeah, it, I knew it was going to go well, not that well, obviously, but I knew it was going to go well because when I started talking to universities about it, you know, I was getting a, you know, some of the older professors were outraged, but the younger people, their eyes lit up because they had been thinking just these things. You know, when I was in grade three on King Island, my school teacher told me that when Europeans arrived in Australia, the Aboriginal people just walked off and went to the missions. They aren't. We've got Black Wallaby here now, Auntie Barb, and I can't stop looking at you, Bub. But we were told that, you know, Aboriginal people just up and went into the mission, you know, let's just, you know, eat white bread and drink tea and have lots of sugar. That'll do us. You know, we forget all this other food we've been eating. And it just didn't ring true. But there was nothing in our schooling to tell us otherwise. This is how cultures can be incinerated. Because if the school is not going to suggest something more complex, no one knows it. And so as school children of Australia, we grow up with that idea that Aboriginal people were just bloody hopeless and lazy and wouldn't work and all of these things. And, you know, I wanted to use the word sowing and sowing to indicate a level of sophistication and intimacy that would provoke Australians into a new regard for the First Peoples of the country and how this country had been looked after by those people and how that is our heritage. Our heritage is not a failed referendum. Our heritage will be that this great culture will be acknowledged and loved. Mm. And when people in airport lounges in Heathrow or San Francisco, when asked where they come from, will say, well, we come from the oldest living culture on earth. You know, it's not my culture, but that's my country. That's my country and I'm proud. Mm.
It did take a toll, didn't it?
The book?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're hard things to write, books. You know, the criticism from the book was hard, not because criticism's not hard to absorb, you know, because a lot of our growth is from someone having another opinion about what we're doing. But nastiness.
There was a lot of nastiness.
Well, we're in a pretty nasty society these days in the world where we can't argue anymore. We have to undermine and belittle and slander. It's very sad. I think we can get back to those days where we could have discussions. But once again, it'll be driven by the culture of this land where what I'm writing at the moment is about the fact that there were civilizations in the world that had buildings and had organized agriculture, had organized economies, had organized social welfare and social housing, but they didn't have a king and they didn't have a police and they didn't have an army. Those cultures existed elsewhere in the world, but primarily they existed here. And that those old people and their wisdom and their calmness and their love of their people, it's just inspiring.
And the overpowering feeling I get from Dark Emu and Black Duck actually is the sense that we've hardly scratched the surface of the evidence that's there to be found. I mean, you think of the Brewarrina fish traps, you think of the Mithika mines in southeast Queensland, which unearthed evidence of housing and trade and all sorts of activity.
Look, Mum, that Mithika thing, I hope people can go and examine that, because it's not a book at the moment. It's research papers online, but it's just incredible, because the Michael Westaway gathered a team of scientists together this is in the heat of all the criticism of dark emu. The research was called Testing the Dark Emu Hypothesis. Were there houses? Were there crops? Were there dams? Were there social organisation? Was there division of labour? All of those things that dark emu talks about, this research program was meant to test. And so Michael Westaway is a pretty incredible individual. He's manic. His mother probably had a very hard time, but he's very, very manic. But he knew there was this site, and he thought there were houses there. So he forged a relationship. This is very un-Australian. He forged a relationship with the local Aboriginal community and got their support to investigate these sites. And a fellow called Josh Gorringe and his family allowed him to do that. And Josh's granddad was, when he was alive, opened it up for these people to speculate about his people. And now, in Australia, that's a very courageous thing to do, because you don't want the enemy talking about your great-great-grandmother. But this old man was confident that Michael Westaway was going to do a decent job. So we can live in hope, because there are decent people, and that decency can be accepted. Anyway, they do the investigation. These house sites aren't house sites, they're mines. And from those mines, 4 million, hang on, 3 million, Lynn's voice is in my ear, 3 million sandstone grinding dishes were taken out as blanks, and the people who mined them needed 1,500 in their lifetime of those mines. What happened to the rest of them? They were traded. Was this the first mass trade event on the planet? Probably. It's near the what is probably the oldest human structure on Earth. This is Australia. Not one greyhound bus goes there at the moment. All that's going to change. And the fascinating thing about this science is that they found a skeleton, what they thought was a young girl. And one of the reasons they thought it was a girl, but the pelvis was missing, her forearm, the bone in her forearm had changed from grinding. And so they've gone, oh, righto, it's a woman. Then Josh gave them permission to take a little bit of her tooth, and it turned out she was a boy. So that boy, 16-year-old, had been grinding grain into flour. But the other incredible thing about it was that they, in their lifetime, up until they were 16 and died for whatever reason we don't know, that person had never travelled more than 15 miles from his home. So that's sedentary living. And so all these old furfies that we've been taught about, you know, the nomads, the hunters and gatherers, it's being proven wrong by white science. And, you know, so...
That's ironic, isn't it? Actually.
Well, I find it very cheering, because I have a lot of critics who think that I've been exaggerating things, and And now that these young scientists are going, oh, you know, I get these phone calls. Oh, you know what that bloke was doing? You know, they're talking about this 16-year-old kid. Oh, he ate a lot of vegetables. You know, and I thought, oh, well, that's all right. I'm probably a hippie. But, you know, it's proving a lot of things. It's proving things about the diet, about the houses. There were houses there. They're incredible, beautiful little houses made out of timber and made out of gidgee, really old gidgee, and plastered over with mud and stuff. So there's the housing, there's the trade, there's the, you know,
incredible.
The sedentary living, and there's the culture, because above these mines, over a stretch of 2 or 3 kilometres, we don't even know how far it goes yet, there's a ceremonial path. So these miners were taking part in some kind of ceremony, probably with the people who were coming to get the grinding dish. So here we have an economy where the buyer and the seller dance together. And it says so much about a society that we can look forward to a time when we're not going to be ripped off, but we'll end up having a good dance.
Yeah. I think on that point, there's a little paragraph in the book that I'd like Bruce to read, if you may, because it kind of sums up the whole story, I think, in a way. So I've underlined it there.
I'm always moved by the gentleness of our culture, selecting small things to represent the earth's power. It shows a completely different attitude to the world and the understanding of human existence within it. No heraldry, no arms, no weapons, no butchery, no kings and rooms of gold, but caterpillars and birds that weigh as much as half a dozen cotton buds. I am entranced by that modest these are 77-year-old eyes trying to do this. I'm entranced by the modesty. Aboriginal people are human with all the same characteristics of the species, love and hate, violence and peace, kindness and cruelty, but have an entirely different set of spiritual priorities and governance. I didn't grow up with that knowledge, but became exposed to it gradually thanks to an uncle and several generous elders. It is common for Australians to scoff when I talk about the philosophy, but I am certain that in time the world will understand the value of viewing existence in this light and hopefully ensuring that the originators of this thought can practice it in peace while sharing it with others. Sharing it, not having it usurped.
This conversation was recorded by Two Heads Media for True Story. Thanks to co-curators Sarah Nicholson and Genevieve Swart, and to the Illawarra Flame for ongoing support. The festival is held every spring in November, and we hope to see you there next time. For more information about the festival programme and other events, go to southcoastwriters.org.